Orange Sheets, the Eugene trip. I know, Senator Beyer, you probably don't want to go. We're going to have, this isn't our regular day, so I can't only have three of you gone, so let us know right away if you're interested in that. The Bend trip, where's that list?
Bend trip.
Senator Atkinson, are you going to Bend?
No.
Okay.
I'll
check me out for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe.
All right.
Is it?
And with that little bit of admin out of the way, we will open up a public hearing for SCR 4, memoriam to Mr. Rutherford, or the Rutherford family, I guess now. Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon. Avell Gordley, State Senator from Portland, District 10. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite up to join me Charlotte Rutherford, daughter of Otto and Verdell Rutherford. Mr. Chair, it is with a great sense of respect and emotion that we come before you today with SCR 4. It had been our intention, Mr. Chair, to present a resolution honoring Otto Rutherford, and we wanted to present that resolution to his wife, Verdell, but she made her transition with graceful dignity earlier last month, and that is why we submitted amendments to include Mrs. Verdell Rutherford in this historical document. We are so honored to have their daughter, Charlotte Rutherford, and my dear friend with us this afternoon. Charlotte is an administrative law judge here in Oregon and can tell you a part of their family's remarkable story and contribution to Oregon's history. There is a famous picture in Oregon civil rights history from 1953. It shows Mr. and Mrs. Rutherford with then State Representative Mark Hatfield at Hatfield's House floor desk on the occasion of the Oregon legislature passing landmark civil rights legislation. This was 1953, just 48 years ago. Senator Hatfield led the legislative fight on behalf of the Rutherfords and others who led the fight from the community to the halls of our state capitol. And, Mr. Chair, that famous picture belongs in the halls of this capitol. And with your help, I intend to make sure that it gets installed. And I now want to ask Charlotte Rutherford, the daughter of the late Otto and Verdell Rutherford, to speak about her parents and their legacy, and then you will understand why the photo, and I have the photo with me and I'll share it with the staff. You will understand why the photo belongs in the halls of the Capitol outside the House chamber, and then you will also understand why every Oregon school student should learn about the life and times of Verdell and Otto Rutherford and the Oregon Civil Rights Movement.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. For the record, my name is Charlotte Rutherford, and I'm a Multnomah County citizen. I was born in 1947, and my formative years are memories of my mother mimeographing and my dad making speeches with regard to the legislation that was passed in 1953. My parents had always been active in Portland's civic affairs, and this tribute to them may be just what my dad needed to have amends made for the years he spent fighting every day, going to school, being called the N-word, and being excluded from all of the public accommodations, theaters, restaurants, and whatnot that were owned by whites in this town. My dad was born here in 1911 at a time when there were very few African-American families in this town. And he paid a very heavy price to live a life of dignity here. A couple of years ago, shortly before my dad was put into a foster home because of his ill health, the same picture that's being circulated appeared in the Oregonian, and Senator Mark Hatfield contacted my parents and asked if they minded if he came over and visited with them for a while. My mother insisted that I come also, and I did, and I'm pleased to have this picture to show you. He spent about an hour talking with my folks about those days and said at that time that the Oregon Civil Rights Bill was his crowning achievement as far as legislation went, which I was very surprised to hear him say after all those years working in the federal system, to say that this early piece of legislation for the state of Oregon was his crowning achievement. After my mother passed, Senator Hatfield sent me a note, and I'd like to read it to you because I think it sums up everything I could say, and I would like to believe those who knew my folks would also say about them. It's dated March 9, 2001. Dear Charlotte, now Verdell has joined Otto, and we know they are with the hosts of heaven singing praise to the Lord. How blessed we have all been to have them as friends. Our warmest love to all your family. Love, Mark. I think that said it all. And the state of Oregon and the citizens of Oregon owe my parents a great deal of appreciation for all their volunteer efforts and hard work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there's one additional piece of information that I would share with you about Mrs. Rutherford. When she came to Oregon, when her family came to Oregon, it was from Wainwright, Oklahoma. And the family wanted to move as far west as possible after a tornado destroyed their home. The family moved to Bend, Oregon, where Verdell and Verdine Rutherford, when she was 9 months old, and the family wanted to obtain land under the Homestead Act. But what they discovered after their arrival in Bend was that African Americans were prohibited from receiving land under the Act. And so the family then moved to and settled in Marshfield, Oregon, which is now known as Coos Bay, and they lived there for 7 years before moving on and finally settling in Portland. It's a remarkable, remarkable history, and it is our history to claim. And again, every student, every school student in our state should learn about and understand and appreciate the life and times of Mr. and Mrs. Otto Rutherford and their contributions to the Oregon Civil Rights Movement. And again, with your help, we will get the picture that you have with the family and Mr. and Mrs. Rutherford and Senator Hatfield on the House floor. We will get that installed in the halls of the state capitol because that's where it belongs.
You want to borrow my hammer?
I'll take you up on that offer.
Ready.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Kathy.
Thank you.
Starts with an S.
Galbraith.
Starts with an S. I meant G. And Harold Gaskin. Gaskin. Starts with a G.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am extremely proud to be here today to speak in favor of this resolution that is before you honoring Otto and Verdell Verdine Rutherford. I am privileged to have known them and to have learned so much from them about Oregon history and in particular African American history. Imagine what it must be like to have your history ignored for most of your life and for generations before you and generations since. They worked to change that, and they helped those of us that are a couple of generations following them to also work to change that. And they helped so much to bring so much information forward. One of the, I think, the particular qualities or contributions that Mrs. Rutherford in particular made was to preserve so much of Oregon's African-American history, which would have been discarded otherwise. I brought a book today which is called African-American Historic Places. It was published by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and what it does is list buildings throughout our country that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places for their associations with African-Americans. And one of, I think, the most disturbing facts about this book is that there is not a single resource in the state of Oregon or the state of Washington that's listed in the National Register. We're working to change that. A nomination for the family home of the Rutherford family from 1921 to the present in Northeast Portland has been submitted to the State Historic Preservation Office, and it will be heard before the State Advisory Committee at their meeting in May. This honor is very deeply deserved by Mr. and Mrs. Rutherford, and I only wish that they could be here, because the only thing that's better about accolades after you're gone, of course, is to be here to hear them for yourself. They did very much appreciate the day of reconciliation and acknowledgement during the last session, which they followed in the newspaper and on the news, and for the personal accounts for those of us that were able to attend that very historic day. You know, Otto and Fidelberdine Rutherford changed Oregon history, and I think you have an opportunity to take another step forward to rectify some of the oversight, the lack of acknowledgement that's been given to some people who have made some really significant contributions. We're so fortunate that not only that they stayed in Oregon, but they persevered. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Harold?
Honorable Senators, I have known Otto and Verdell for many years. I came to Portland in 1930, and Otto was one of the first persons I met. I've been fortunate in being associated with the family, and I've been able to realize all the good things that Otto and Verdell have done. I am a golfer, and I enjoyed playing the game, and I can remember very, very well that before Otto and Verdell worked so hard to get the Bill of Rights passed, we could not play golf on certain ones of the golf courses. After that, after he got the bill passed, I was privileged to be able to play on golf courses that I never thought I would ever be able to play on. I think that Otto and Verdell deserve and should be put in this position that they are being nominated for. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else like to chat about this? This is exciting. This is neat. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on SCR-4. Open up the work session on SCR-4. Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to SCR-4, please.
Senator Courtney moves the -1 amendments to SCR-4. Discussion. Objection. Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR-4 is amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves SCR-4 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion, hearing no objections. So ordered. Thank you very much. Senator Gordley to carry that. Yes, without question. And I am to get my hammer, which he told me, yes. For that, we'll close the work session on SCR-4. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 770. Senator Brown, if you will.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. I'm here, and I'm going to speak briefly to you on behalf of Senate Bill 770. You have my written testimony. The bill directs the agencies of the state of Oregon to continue building productive working relationships with the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. It builds on Executive Order 96-30 that Governor Kitzhaber signed in May of 1996, at the request of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. and acknowledges the critical role of the legislative branch in setting state and tribal relations policy that will last beyond a term of a particular governor. Colleagues, for your information, this is the first bill of its kind in the nation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have this matter heard. I did want to recognize Anton Minthorn is going to be speaking in a moment, but I did want to recognize Chairwoman Catherine Harrison. She's chair of the Confederated Tribes of the Ganron, and she's here in the room today. Catherine, thank you very much for all of your hard work. You are truly an incredible woman. Now I'm going to turn it over to Anton and Ed Larson from the Confederated Tribes of the Ganron. You want to go first?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Anton Minthorn, and I am chairman of the Board of Trustees, the governing body of the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation. And also with me today is our staff assistant, Elena Nanigas. I appreciate and welcome the opportunity to appear before this committee to express our strong support for Senate Bill 770, a bill that would legislate the government-to-government policy and initiative between the state and Oregon tribes that begin with Governor Kitzhaber's Executive Order 9630. I also want to thank Senators Kate Brown and Bev Clarno for the sponsorship of Senate Bill 770. Historically, the tribal governments have most interacted with the federal government. We entered treaties with the United States. It is the federal government that owes a trust responsibility to the tribes, and it is Congress that possesses broad constitutional authority to legislate in the area of Indian affairs. Nonetheless, there is an increasing need for the interaction of tribal and state governments. Consider these examples. Natural resources. The state and tribe share common interests such as water, fish, and wildlife that require our joint management. Gaming. Congress increasingly requires states and tribes to work together on important governmental objectives, such as tribal-state compacts to address casino gaming concerns. Land. Recently, the Department of Interior regulations were issued regarding taking lands into trust. Education. Tribes and states share a common interest in improving the education of our youth. Most of our elementary and high school students attend state schools. Developing a trained workforce for our tribal government and enterprises will require the joint efforts of our governmental agencies. I have no doubt that there will be a continuing need for a cooperative and constructive working relationship between the state and Oregon tribes as we witness the continued downsizing of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other federal agencies that have historically operated as a buffer between tribal and state governments. The Confederated Tribes' commitment to a government-to-government relationship with the state is not a hypothetical one. We have codified our commitment by passage of Resolution 9974B, which established the Confederated Tribes' policy regarding the government-to-government relationship with the state. The resolution required our department directors to identify a contact person for interactions with state agencies and required annual reporting on interactions with and cooperative initiatives involving state programs. The point of these government-to-government contacts is, of course, to produce improvements in our respective governmental programs. We have already seen successes in the areas of social services programs, natural resources efforts in the area of salmon restoration and water quality improvement in economic development and transportation planning. With the institutionalization of the government-to-government relationship between tribes and states in SB 770, I expect the list of cooperative tribal-state governmental initiatives to expand. The state of Oregon and the 9 federally recognized tribes in the state have much to gain by a cooperative working relationship. While the Confederated Tribes has not always agreed with its state and local government counterparts, our experience shows that there is more to be gained by cooperating than by being at odds with one another. The Confederated tribes, like the other tribes of Oregon, have made significant contributions to and sacrifices for the state and its non-Indian residents, including title to millions of acres of land and the devastation of sacred salmon runs in rivers throughout the region. The government-to-government relationship that would be institutionalized by SB 770 can and should address problems associated with these historic tribal contributions to our state as well as to modern-day problems. We have and must continue to work cooperatively with state agencies for salmon restoration, environmental protection, economic development, education, social services, and health care concerns. SB 770 will not resolve all our differences. Rather, it commits the state to a policy of interaction on a government-to-government basis with their tribal governmental counterparts to address problems of mutual concern. It is important that this policy established by Oregon's current governor be institutionalized with the passage of SB 770 so that we have the tools to constructively and cooperatively address issues of mutual concern with our respective governmental capabilities into the future. Thank you for the opportunity to address your committee on this important bill. For the record, I am enclosing a copy of the Board of Trustees Resolution 9974B in my recent comments at the annual government-to-government meeting between the state and Oregon tribes. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Harper and members of the committee for this opportunity today. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think okay.
My name is Ed Larson. I'm the Tribal Council Vice Chairman for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Island Community. Also with me in the back are June Sell, Lori Smith, Tim Holmes, and of course, Justin Martin. We're here and we're proud to be here representing the tribe as well as Oregonians in support of Senate Bill 770. I'm going to give you 4 points to think about from the work of Governor Kitzhaber. Back to the when Governor Victor Attia started this, various legislative assemblies, Native American tribes in the state of Oregon have worked very hard to create positive government-to-government relationships. Number two, the passage of this Senate Bill 770 would institutionalize this government-to-government relationship, ensuring that the goodwill and future vision found here in Oregon between the tribes and the state will continue. Three, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Round realized the importance of building strong relationships with other governments while helping to provide an educational background of the status and direction of the tribal governments within Oregon. Four, Oregon's situation is truly unique. State and tribe are showing that by example, the productive results that can come from reciprocal communication, education, and cooperation between governments. Again, we urge your support of Senate Bill 770. It's a very positive and unique piece of legislation that will allow for Oregon to continue to be a leader in positive government-to-government relationships with Native American tribes.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Justin, did you want to... Where'd Justin go?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want on here? He did a good job. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to call him, but this time, LaVon Edma, who's chair of the Commission on Indian Services, as well as Chip Lazenby from Governor's Legal Counsel, who is in the room. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is LaVon Lobert Edmo, and I serve as chair of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. I am here to urge your supportive passage of Senate Bill 770. The 25-year-old commission serves as an advisory body to you, the legislature, and to the executive branch. The commission monitors state-tribal relations and makes suggestions for improvements. It is a forum that has high-level representation, 4 tribal chairs and 5 tribal council members from Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes currently sit on the commission, in addition to 2 legislators, including Senator Kate Brown, and 2 Indians representing non-reservation Indians in Oregon, appointed by the Speaker and the President of the Senate. Without doubt, the relationship building that has occurred under Executive Order 9630 between state agencies and Oregon tribes over the past 5 years is very impressive. One time a year, the governor, tribal leaders, and the Commission on Indian Services and state agency and tribal representatives meet to assess the condition of state-tribal relations. As Kate mentioned, 3 to 4 times a year, clusters meet to tackle the specifics of government-to-government work. The Natural Resource Cluster, which, as an example, has the following participants: Department of Forestry, Department of Environmental Quality, Division of State Lands, Water Resources, Department of Land Conservation and Development, Agriculture, Department of Energy, and the Military Department, and their tribal counterparts, had their most recent meeting here in Salem in February. The agencies in the tribes identify areas of shared concern and consider interagency cooperation in other ways to address such issues such as watershed health, the Oregon plan process, and potential for tribal involvement, briefing on air quality planning, national firefighting program, state landfill and removal program, cultural resource protection planning, and state law and review of proposed legislative measures that may affect tribal interests. The purpose of the cluster meetings is to explore the common areas of interest of concern and to discuss whether and what type of coordinated action might be appropriate. The natural resource clusters may discuss joint fire management. The cultural resources cluster may discuss training and archaeological laws for state police who have statutory responsibilities in the area but may not know what is a cultural resource. The public safety cluster may discuss a process to notify tribes when tribal youth are taken into custody so there can be some joint planning for the eventual transition of the tribal youth when released. The goal of both parties is to increase chances the youth will not re-enter the system. The economic development and community services cluster has an ongoing discussion of infrastructure, possibilities for joint projects, leveraging both federal and grant dollars for the benefit of all Oregonians. In addition, there is a lot of discussion about employers who are interested in locating in Oregon and want to know about doing business in Indian country. I could give you many more examples where important and strong relationships are being built under the government-to-government process. I offer a copy of the annual report each state agency makes on its individual work with Oregon tribes. Senate Bill 770 will encourage state agencies to keep exploring positive ways to work with tribes. Senate Bill 770 recognizes the need to communicate, to learn about each other's governmental structures, priorities, and programs, to see where it might make sense for the different governments to try to work together on some common issues. Many states have rocky relationships with tribes. Many states are now trying to copy the Oregon model. All Oregonians gain by the legislative branch involvement in a respectful approach to government-to-government relations with Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes. I urge your support of Senate Bill 770. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chip?
For the record, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm legal counsel to Governor John Kitzhaber. I have provided for the committee's consideration a letter of strong support from Governor Kitzhaber for Senate Bill 770. 770 encapsulates the executive order that the governor signed nearly 5 years ago when he recognized that it was important for us to coordinate and communicate with the sovereign nations within our borders. And from a personal experience, I just want to say I've seen state agency people migrate from wondering what issues affect tribes to actually raising those issues on their own as we develop policy and starting to put together budgets. And I think that's real progress. But the governor has worried about how to keep the executive order, which could be rescinded by the next governor, how to put that into effect so that it would continue to go. And 770, I believe, is the vehicle for that. And I'm grateful to Senator Brown for taking the initiative and crafting this legislation and introducing it. And what all the other speakers have told you is true. If you look to the north of us, you look to the south of us, and practically any place east of us, states and tribes are involved in litigation They're involved in strife and conflict. And the one place where tribes and state governments are sitting down together and talking is in the state of Oregon, and we're yielding some productive results. So Governor Kitzhaber urges this committee to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation so that we can ensure that this process is enshrined in statute and will guide future administrations beyond his own.
Thank you. Would you, Chip, for the record, make sure we have documented what the problem is and what 770 fixes?
Well, I can give you some Mr. Chair, I can give you some anecdotal circumstances that led the governor to believe that it was necessary to improve our coordination. We were engaged in a negotiation over water with one of the tribes because several departments had an issue. And the tribal negotiators very politely listened to us for a couple of sessions before they pointed out to us that they thought it was unusual that we were objecting to this on these legal grounds since the state was also providing the funding for the project. So we quickly called a timeout and backed up. And
your answer.
Timeout. But I think that was symptomatic. When we began the process of trying to talk to state agencies about the need for this, and as you know, for something as large as this, you need to do a lot, have a lot of meetings. But I sat in a room with a number of state agency people, and as we went around the room, I just had them describe their interactions with the Oregon tribes, and we got about halfway around before people on my right were saying, gosh, I didn't know that was going on. And that is what the cluster structure of the executive order does. It takes state agency people and matches them with tribal government people who share the same expertise. They meet three or four times a year, and then there's a meeting at the end of the year in which all of the key contacts from both the tribes and the state agencies come together. The annual reports are a centralized way of letting everybody know of all the work that we're doing together and also all the issues that we still are trying to work on. So it's communication and coordination, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, but doing it on a level that focuses on, as the governor often says, that we have more in common than what divides us. And I think that's easily lost when you get too many lawyers involved in the process and you don't have real people trying to solve problems sitting down together to do it. And that's what it tries to solve, Senator.
I'm glad you recognize that. I think the other thing I heard
I
you
am
say,
one. I don't love them, Senator.
This has been working now for 4 or 5 years, and we would like to institutionalize it. That's the other thing I heard you say.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Richard Acevedo. How'd they do? Acevedo?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Richard Acevedo, and I'm the Tribal Relations Liaison for the Department of Human Services, and I've been in that capacity the past 3 years, and prior to that I worked for the Department in Services to Children and Families, and I was the Indian Child Welfare Act Manager for the state for approximately 10 years. So I've had an opportunity to work from the state's perspective of working with the relationship with the tribes and seeing how that has developed over the years. Mm-hmm. And since the envisionment of the Senate Bill 77 or the governor's executive order, I want to talk about the improvement I've seen in the relationships over the past 14 years and how this would simply enhance and continue that improving process. The Department of Human Services has enjoyed a long history of working cooperatively with the Indian tribes of Oregon and the urban Indian communities. Historically, our relationship has been strong in several areas, including Indian child welfare, health care, mental health, prior to the governor's executive order 9630. The executive order has spurred the development of additional partnerships between the Department of Human Services divisions and the tribes of Oregon in the areas of alcohol and drug rehabilitation services to seniors, public health services, and healthcare services. The executive order has also resulted in a growth of regular quarterly meetings with the tribes of Oregon to discuss a variety of topics of mutual interest, including mental health, the issues of alcohol and drug services, access to health care, and child protective services. One positive outcome of these strengthened relationships includes new contracts with the tribes that assist the tribes in providing foster care for children under the tribal jurisdiction. Also, meetings have increased the awareness of abuse involving seniors and how to prevent it. We're now working on strategies to prevent domestic violence and the reduction in the use of alcohol and tobacco products. The Department of Human Services continues to work to improve its relationship with the tribes of Oregon. We have found the executive order has strengthened the existing relationship, has encouraged the department employees to work in new and creative ways with the tribes. Senate Bill 770 would demonstrate the state's continuing relationship between the tribes and the Department of Human Services. Senate Bill 770 would work as a focal point in the department's relationships with the tribes. Its passage would reinforce our message to our employees about the unique status of Indian tribes as nations within the nation and the sovereign status of those tribes. Senate Bill 770 requires state agencies to provide a written report to the Commission on Indian Services on the activities and interaction with the tribes during the previous year. This would ensure the state government keeps the needs of the tribes in mind as they develop new policies, practices, and procedures. Senate Bill 770 would continue the work that Oregon has undertaken as a national leader in its relationship with the tribes of Oregon and would also serve as another model for other states to follow. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Granton?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Granton Cairns representing the Oregon University System. Been directed by Mr. Don Van Louvenay, who is chair of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, and Joe Cox, who is chancellor for the Oregon University System, to report to the committee that we are in enthusiastic support of Senate Bill 770 and wish to have the 96-30 executive order codified and improved in this statute. The university system through the education cluster has been able to meet regularly and provide education to educators in Oregon about the needs and the ability to serve the tribes. University system has worked under the executive order very diligently in this regard, and the responsibility for this government-to-government obligation rests squarely in the chancellor's office, where he believes it needs to be, and would continue that under this statute. We have had a long and we hope productive relationship with tribes in Oregon, running back many years from a campus-based initiative process prior to the executive order, under the executive order, and would look forward to improving that level of service and understanding and communication under this statute. I would recommend it to you.
So the ball's told you to come down, huh? Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lewis Pitt.
Good afternoon, Nick Lawick. My name is Louis Pitt, Jr. I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I've been working in intergovernmental work for about 20 years now, in one form or another. Formally, finally got the title that goes along with the job. So, Education Committee. I made the mistake of telling them I enjoy my work so much I do it for free almost, and that's, they believe me. So. Senate Bill 770. One of the biggest problems we have in Indian country is, I guess, the different timelines that this various governments are on. Our tribe has this incredibly long timeline, and we've been able to, I think, institutionalize that to a degree that makes good sense to us, but very difficult to work with state and federal governments and local governments, too, to get those things carried out. The health of watersheds, our way of life connected to fish, wildlife habitat, roots, berries, our various rights off-reservation. The government-to-government is an answer to a question that I've always been perplexed with, is that how do we continue the gains that we've made in working with the state, whether it be with the legislation down here or whether it be with agencies? And this Senate Bill 770 is one of the answers, I do believe, not the total answer. I wish there were, you know, as you know, some things were that simple. To find one answer for one problem, great, we could do it. But here it's part of the answer to simplifying our relationship with the state agencies. And again, the state agencies, just like any other bureaucracy, is I don't have much patience for the shell game. I don't have much patience for the closed door, open door type of thing, is that it has been able to help us corner individuals, I call them, of influence, that are able to help us protect our interests, our decision makers. And within that, those are the agency directors and agency lieutenants, et cetera, that really can help us get to the answer instead of just starting at the bottom and working up, of which, again, tribes have limited resources. I think the building of personal relationships that we've had over the last 3 years with the government-to-government executive order, 9630, has been positive. I think our attorneys are somewhat frustrated, with all due respect to attorneys, that we're getting into more of a relationship building and talking about problems out front rather than when we're button heads. And so to me, it saves us a few dollars in time and resources there. And again, this is a dream that, again, our way of life is connected to resources off reservation. I know that some of you are very comfortable with our way of life on reservation. You Indians, sure, you don't go to your reservation. No, the Warm Springs Confederated Tribes has rights off reservation, co-management. We have this shotgun marriage with the state of Oregon called USV Oregon that says we're co-managers when it comes to the fish resource. And we have similar relationships to our other ways of life guaranteed by treaty with roots, berries, water quality, and definitely right around the reservation. So it's been I think, just like some of you may be hearing this for the first or second time, is that that's been the challenge for us too with the Oregon agencies, is that with the sheer numbers of agencies, we have, when it comes to water, with regulatory enforcement and incentives and, there's about five other governmental functions. If you An environmental group lined these up on a matrix chart one time, and there were like 22 agencies that had some sort of say over water, state agencies, and that's not counting about the 18 agencies that could have say from the federal government over that same water that you're talking about. So for us to try to group, round up the usual suspects, you might say, is that have the state try to simplify itself is really something that we would like to encourage. Not so much as I think you folks have the same type of challenges too, but not so much right now. We've got a lot of good people doing good things, and that's the thing that I worry about. I'm a good person that believes in my tribe, and my tribe is a sovereign, and in the state of Oregon, and I love the state of Oregon also, and I'm a good American and all that. How do we make all this work? I'm willing to work with folks in a hopefully proactive way and whatever. Well, we have some tribal members that aren't willing to do that. They'd much rather, I think communication's a wonderful thing, is that some folks think the answer to poor communications is no communications in Indian country. So this would help, I think, firm that up, that we would sit down with our counterparts in the state agencies and be able to talk equal level there about mutual interest problems and some unique problems that are just due to our inherent nature that we're so different. The tribes that have some things that are so different is we have to respect and honor those. And I think with the few groups, cluster groups that I've worked with, the cultural resources, natural resources, and just touched on education the other day, They met with our cluster group under this government-to-government relationship. We're solving kind of with synergy is a number of problems. It's taking longer than I would like, to be honest, but we're doing more than I would be doing jumping up and down. I think the standards that are needed in some sort of approach like this is that we need to have. I just got the Oregon benchmarks the other day, especially with fish. On fish, is that we need to have progress. And I think it was 1998. We graded ourselves with fish, with salmon and steelhead. We got an F. And then in 2000, what grade did we get on salmon and steelhead? We got another F as the state of Oregon, and that impacts us. Well, I don't call that progress. Is that how are we going to use, I think, not so much in salmon, but how are we going to figure out a way to grade ourselves in this government-to-government relationship to directional, gaining direction towards success. I think that's always needed. I like benchmarks. We're going to use benchmarks on reservation. We're using regional benchmarks, and in the state of Oregon, occasionally we pull those out and thump some state agency folks with those and say, look here, you know, we're talking this, and yourself, you're saying you're not doing well in this arena. How can we do better? How can we help you do better? So anyway, that's my comments. I apologize for nothing in writing at this point. Again, I just the Confederated Tribes is in support of anything that does help simplify our relationship. Not too simple. It's that we have that. I think our attorneys like to, well, this would simplify things. It does not. Is that it's not an easy task, I think, that we've appreciated. And I didn't get to listen to Chairman Minthorne's discussion, but I know that he supported the process. Our chairman supports the process, has spoke to it. And it's really interesting what our chairman talked about, because a number of the agencies and even the governor was talking about a historic occasion. He's talking to the meeting. They were talking about the meeting. And our chairman said, you know, it'll be historic if we do something with this meeting, in these meetings. So that's what we hope to do, is that, you know, let's not just meet to be meeting. Let's meet to solve problems, mutual problems, et cetera. So, chairman and committee, I appreciate your time here, and we're in support of the bill from March.
Thank you very much. Kathy Toole? We'll do it correctly if you'll tell me.
Well, I don't really know. It's a German name that used to be pronounced Tolle. My husband's brother was in the service and pronounced it Thole. And some people can't say Thole, so say whatever you want.
Well, there's a Thule Greenland spelled the same way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
So now you've got a third one.
Chairman Harper and committee members, what good would Senate Bill 770 do for we the people? Who's here to speak for all Oregonians? Who's here to affirm our mutual constitution? You commemorated the black man in SJR, whatever it was, I'm sorry, SCR 4, for his participation in our Bill of Rights. What are we going to do to our Bill of Rights? Under Article 1 of the Bill of Rights, we the people have the right to change our form of government or keep our form of government. What good will Senate Bill 770 do we the people? Now, you've got everybody here from every state agency that needs to follow Governor Kitzhaber's Executive Order 9630. What one of them fails to mention, at any rate, Diane Middle, she fails to mention that Governor Kitzhaber's 9630 says, maximizing intergovernmental relations and enhancing the exchange of ideas and resources for the greater good of Oregon citizens. His executive order says for all of Oregon citizens. not just tribes. I think you have my written testimony. Was passed out anyway, so I'll just go ahead and read it, if it's all right with you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify against this bill. Does the state of Oregon have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government that mandates that the federal government cooperate with the state of Oregon? Of course, the answer is no. Our elected federal government represents all of its constituents, regardless of which of the 50 states we live in under our Constitution. Does our Oregon Constitution allow a government-to-government relationship with special interests? Of course, the answer is no. If this bill were to pass this legislature, it would create a new form of government by including tribal governments in decision-making processes and policies, I meant to say, that affect all of us citizens. As you know, the right and obligation to change or keep Oregon's form of government is secured to the people by Article 1, our Bill of Rights, Oregon Constitution. Each tribe has its own constitution, which should have jurisdiction only over their own constituents and their lands. They intend, and many, many past and ongoing cases in the courts attest, to take jurisdiction over the rest of us citizens. And you know the rest of us cannot vote on tribal government while they can vote on you. They are already more than equally represented. If you vote for this bill, you are voting my civil rights away. Please amend this bill to provide for its submission to the people of Oregon for our approval or rejection. You may find the attached papers significant, and thank you for this opportunity to address you. And then, can I proceed, or would you prefer I did not?
Go ahead.
Okay. This from United Property Owners of Washington. Well, it's really all over the country now. It's a sad but true fact of life that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
Excuse me, are you just going to read the attachment that you have?
Yeah, if you don't want me to, I will.
Would you like to summarize it for
us? Well, yes, I will summarize it. That little paragraph on the second page that is checked. As tribes across America move to tax and regulate their non-Indian neighbors, tragic new conflicts are growing. The special rights and privileges, unique tax exemptions, and business monopolies enjoyed by tribes are building a wall separating Indians from Main Street America. And if you pass this bill, you will be really further separating Indians and the rest of us.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's all we have signed up. Anybody else like to testify?
Mr. Chair, if I might also just for the record, there's several different state agencies that have submitted statements on Senate Bill 770, Oregon Youth Authority, the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, Department of Justice, and also Yamhill County Commissioner Thomas Bunn. Members, you should all have that in front of you somewhere.
Okay. Thank you, Craig. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 770 and open up a work session.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
I would move Senate Bill 770 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 770 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And you will be the carrier, do I assume?
Senator Clarno assist me in that.
Senator Clarno and Senator Brown will be co-carriers. Absolutely. With that, we will close the work session on SB 770. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 729. Senator Decker. Okay, well. We will close the public hearing and open a short recess. We'll give him 30 seconds to appear.
In 30 seconds.
29.
Should I go get Senator Menes and Senator Atkinson? Do they have the handout? Mr. Chair, Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Beaverton and Tigard. I bring before you Senate Bill 729, and the notion behind this is, and I've kind of followed this whole campaign finance reform debate for at least 6-8 years, and they're certainly debating it right now in the U.S. Senate. The three different schools of thought are obviously, one, publicly funded campaigns, which I think is a bad idea. Two is very, very strongly restricting, and we went through this in 1996, the amount with strict limits, which were involuntary and was ruled unconstitutional. But I also thought it was problematic because the limits were so low that you just incentivized other groups, outside groups, to come with real money outside of disclosure laws and outside of the system. So I thought that was a bad idea. And that's what led me to Senate Bill 729, because I really do think this is the way that you get at a privately financed campaign finance measure with reasonable limits. And I'm very open to the limits. And this is informed by what Maine did. They created a political accountability fund. Welcome. They created a political accountability fund by doing a couple things to draw a fund together. And then they created a voluntary system. And I think that is the key. Obviously, it meets the court test. But I, as a candidate, voluntarily choose to set, and I'm open to what the reasonable limits are, but reasonable limits in terms of how much money I raise and spend in a raise. I know from just being a candidate in 1996 that I think $100.40,000 for a state rep race was not reasonable. I think that was too low. Conversely, I know from running in this last election, and my opponent and myself spent about $1.4 million. We had groups that contributed over or at least around $100,000 with no limits at all, either in contributions or expenditures. I think that led, and I think we'll see this in Oregon, is...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
I would like to interrupt Senator Decker because I think I had a conversation with him maybe 4 months out, 5 months out for the election, and I guessed, total guessed, the amount of money that would be spent on his campaign. And Senator Decker, what was your reaction?
It was $1 million.
So what was your reaction to my guess?
Oh, I did that for the benefit of my friend from Jacksonville. I thought that it was unbelievably high to guesstimate that we would spend $1 million in a state Senate race. I thought that was
you didn't have to.
Way high. And I didn't pull my own weight in that race in terms of, but I think that's the system that you get.
Job pays $1,000 a month, you know.
Best it wasn't.
Mr. Chair, I do believe that's the system we're going to have, is that without any limits at all and any form of, and that's why I think this actually, the idea that before you is a creative way of finding a privately financed campaign, ensuring that most campaigns, and that's what they're finding in Maine, is that most of them are privately financed and they have a limit system and inflation adjusted so that it moves up through time that creates reasonable limits that you really can finance a campaign with enough funds to do it properly, but with limits. And I really do think that's where the ball game is, because you use your public funds, and I think it's an incredibly creative way that I didn't think of myself, but just copying what Maine did, I think it's a creative way of putting a system together where you create a pool of funds so that the incentive on me, if I'm running in a race and I've agreed to a limit for, say, for state Senate, my expenditures to $125,000, and I'm open if the committee likes this idea and would want to move forward of bumping that up and finding what reasonable limits would be and then inflation adjusted. If I voluntarily opt in, if I'm running for state Senate and say it's $200,000 and I'm going to cap my contributions at $2,000, so that no group or individual would give me over $2,000, then my opponent who's running against me, if I've agreed to those, say my opponent goes out and takes a $10,000 or $15,000 contribution, the political accountability fund just simply matches that contribution. So I think it's a really innovative and creative way of finding ways to incentivize just limits and reasonable limits, which I think in the long run would do us well, because I think what we'll find is if we don't limit it, either the voters will do it in a more onerous fashion, or we will just get what we have, and it's the last page of my testimony, which I think almost every time we're going to double, and I think we'll see this again in the 2002 cycles, we'll just double the funds that are going into our state legislative, state governor races. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Rules Committee, that is the idea I bring before you. I think it's one that certainly caught my attention when I saw it, because I think it's the best idea I've seen out there on for states to tackle this issue of campaign finance reform and to do it in a way that really appeals to Republicans and Democrats, because it keeps the notion of privately financed campaigns alive with reasonable limits, and it meets the court challenge because it's completely voluntary for a candidate to do it. Thank you.
Could you go into the fund, your funding source for the accountability fund, Senator Jacob?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I listed out in my testimony a number of sources, if the committee was so inclined and really did find this idea intriguing as I did, a number of sources that you could go to get your fund. And I think that's the key, is that you need some sort of fund so that candidate X versus candidate Y, candidate X gets matched if the limits are broken. So we've listed out a few. I think the repeal of the tax credit would be the first place I would go. I think my friend from Lake Oswego has just made such an incredibly strong case for the repeal of this, in that I would use that as the first place that I would go to, and that would generate about $4 million, and that might, in fact, do it. Other places that I think...
Excuse me, you don't think there will be other people in the building after that $4
million? I like the first part of the statement. <didn't> repeal.
Well, I think there's just such a strong nexus, Mr. Chair, for that. If you repeal the political tax credit and you used it, the $4 million basically to create this fund so that in state races that we know, I think a lot of, and all of us have been involved in these races, but I think all of us know that when it comes to campaign season, and I think next time it'll occur again, is that we will just get into a feeding frenzy, and the sky's the limit. And I do know, based on my experience, that down the stretch, we had to think of creative ways to spend that money. But it's just because I did think about that very, very hard. But I think that's the environment that you foster. I think you foster that when you have no limits and you have nothing. I think you foster an environment where you just are trying to keep up and raise just literally as much money as you possibly can, just to ensure that you're keeping up. And I think that's my great hope with this idea, is that at some point, hopefully this idea takes hold, is that we can limit ourselves and do it in a kind of innovative, creative way that obviously meets the court challenge and does it voluntarily. The other sources are the DMV vanity license plate. They do that in Indiana. That would generate $1.7 million to donate to this. Indiana uses that, their vanity license plates, for political party purposes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Menes.
Ryan, what's the problem with asking people for money as opposed to taking it away from them by some means, some fee, some tax, you know, reappropriating it and just redistributing it, having the government redistribute it? Why, what's wrong with just asking people to contribute and letting them give you as much as they feel comfortable?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, I guess and I think that's the heart of the question, that in terms of campaign finance, I think certain organizations are able to buy undue influence.
Such as?
In the legislative process. I don't know that, and it's interesting, Mr. Chair, Senator Miss, when you listen to the federal debate on this, and I think John McCain puts it pretty well, is that if you look at just the overall shape of legislation, and I do buy into this idea that certain groups that give heavily and are heavily invested, there's a reason for that. I think there's a reason that certain groups are so heavily invested and spend such an incredible amount of money on. And, you know, here's the great sign. We probably all had this discussion at one point in our lives. But I talked to one group who had a couple of initiatives they wanted to get accomplished in the legislature. And so the first thing they did, you know, I was asking, well, what's the first thing you did? We started a PAC, and we started raising a lot of money. They didn't hire policy experts to hone their idea, to, you know, or build a grassroots organization or do anything. They did, and I think I would counsel them the same way if I was their representative, is the first thing you might want to do is get a really big PAC and make a lot of contributions. Not that that's going to ensure success, because I think there's many examples where that didn't, but I do think that you're able to certainly buy your way into our game that way. And I think certain groups all across the board, I think certain groups have certainly been able to buy their place in to our game.
So Senator Decker testifies in committee he can be bought. Senator Miller.
You done?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. I just a little ado. I have successfully ticked off probably everybody that's mm-hmm. ever contributed to my campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of fascinated by what you say, because for whatever reason I have this stroke of being independent,
mm-hmm.
and that's my reputation, and it's caused me great consternation from time to time. But for whatever reason, people still do contribute to the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fascinating phenomenon.
Yeah, I've been fascinated by that for years.
About how he ticks everybody off.
Mr. Chair?
Just a second.
Okay.
Thanks. I just have this handout here of the raised and spent through September 29 of last year. In the particular race you cited, the one you were involved in, do you recall whether or not you raised and spent the majority of the money in that $1.4 million campaign? Or
wow. No, I think this is rough. I think at the end of the day, from point A to point B, at least Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, in my campaign, I think we estimate we spent about 500 of the, or 525.
Of the 1.4?
Of the 1.4.
So that and other races I see here, like McCorkle and Messerly, money did not prevail. Tell me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I would absolutely agree. I mean, I think you have to have a competitive level, but I don't think money is the determining factor at all. I mean, I think you have to be in the ballpark, but I don't think money is the determining factor in terms of the outcomes of races. But I think we all do assent to the idea that well-financed campaigns are the ones that have a shot at winning. And so I think we also, if you just look at federal soft money, what happened over 6 years, it went from, I think it was almost $1 billion, and it went from $40 million in the early 1990s in federal soft money, and it's not going doubling or tripling, it's literally going up 5 to 6 times every campaign cycle, because it's just unlimited. And I guess the fear I have, and it's not as bad in Oregon certainly as the federal level, but the fear I have is that I think it turns our political process more into an exercise of fundraising. And I don't think that's necessarily helpful for democracy.
Maybe something, and I'm still searching for those groups that are heavily invested and able to purchase legislators.
What? I'll have a specific sample. It was in the Oregonian today on the front page, and it was Right to Life, and the issue was parental notification, and Right to Life spent $300,000 in this campaign cycle, and they are expecting results. Gail Atterbury said it. She's quoted in the paper. It's very clear that people, when they spend money on campaigns, they expect results. And I can go on with other specific examples, but I don't think you want me to.
I'd be happy to have you do that, because as a matter of fact, it's my impression that people invest in candidates, support candidates who reflect their views.
I think that's
actually a furtherance of free speech, which has been protected certainly by the Oregon Supreme Court and by the United States Supreme Court. What I'd ask is, how much money do we intend to spend, do you think, in financing a baseball stadium or a team here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, in terms of I'd like to address 2 points. First, I think all of us have experienced, I know I have, of at least groups knowing that, boy, we invested heavily in your campaign, and at least implicitly, we did it for certain reasons. Well,
and what do you tell them?
I mean, I think Senator Miller or Senator Menes had the right response, and I think, and I credit him, because I think that is the appropriate is that is not responsible or appropriate, and this is not the forum for it. And I think Senator Menes is a good model of how you handle that. But I do think there is, and maybe Mrs. Atterbury is a good example of at least the thought that they have when they get involved. And I think it's well founded. I think it's a smart rationale. Is the thought that they have is that they will get some sort of action on issues that are important to them, or non-action. But to address your, I don't know if you want me to go into the whole baseball stadium.
Well, just items like baseball, or maybe we could talk about the cost of an ad during the Super Bowl. Just the fact that there's a lot of ways that people purchase a message.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems that we have this onslaught of individuals and groups that seem to want to do everything they can to prevent people from spending their resources in the political arena. And the people who probably support restricting this the most are those who buy their ink by the barrel and who maybe have mm-hmm. nightly television shows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because then their point of view could certainly dominate. I mean, none of us can purchase equal time with the editorial board of the Oregonian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many of us here on this panel get smashed on a daily basis, and we don't have the wherewithal to combat that. And so, you know, I think we get whipped into a frenzy to do things to make sure that some people are not heard. And why it is we are so afraid to have a candidate fully disclose every penny they mm-hmm. get more instantaneously than we now do. That wouldn't bother any of us. And then to the people who are upset with the current system and would expose, and I know there's probably an issue in some campaigns, how you had to answer to people who wondered how come you were raising so much money. I guess if they were uncomfortable with you, the people in your district wouldn't have sent you here. And I'm just saying that why is it we are afraid to first disclose to people who it is we're getting our money from, and secondly, why don't we have confidence that they can make a judgment as to how comfortable they are with us receiving certain amounts? You know, the other thing I'd say is I always hear this refrain about, you know, we get $1,000 a month for being here, and how does that compare to the $100,000, $200,000 you raise in a campaign? Well, it seems to me we're dealing with a $30 billion budget.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is the larger test. Because we might, for instance, swipe $337 million from the taxpayers by some actions of this legislature. That's a whole lot more important to them than our $1,000 a month pay. And if they are interested in that and by their participation through contributions, I don't see anything wrong with that.
Senator Brown.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I have nothing to add. I'm just glad to know that Senator Miller is so in favor of having people know who's spending money and what, because that should apply to ballot measure initiative measures as well.
Senator Menes, that's
the appropriate.
Well, you know, this whole this question is always interesting to me because, you know, the courts have said that the giving of money in campaigns is a form of speech. And being a political moralist, you know, when I look at issues like pornography, if you had a measure that would attempt to limit pornography, everybody who is a protector of the First Amendment seems to come out of the woodwork claiming that we ought not do this because it's somehow protected speech and you shouldn't censor it and so on and so forth. I keep trying to figure out intellectually how it is that we get from that position to politics and say, well, in this case,
mm-hmm.
it's so evil and it's so bad that we should limit this form of speech. I mean, you understand what I'm saying? So we're almost talking out of both sides of our mouths here. I mean, I think in one sense we want to have the perception that politics is clean and politics is, you know, we want to have above board and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that you report, following Senator Miller's, the extent that you support or report contributions, or that it is reported contributions that you don't accept, there's a certain characteristic about who you are as a politician that's presented to the people who may or may not choose you. For instance, if I don't accept money from Right to Pride or Pride Pack or a gay rights organization, then that says something about who I am in terms of some of my views. That becomes very relevant mm-hmm. to the decision voters are going to make about me. And it, see, that's the whole context of speech. And to what extent do we choose in one instance to protect it and say it's outrageous to go there, but in political speech, it's just open game. I mean, to me, it's just troubling. And we want to protect speech, but only to the extent that we, you know, that we protect what I'm saying. And not what somebody else is saying. I mean, it's either what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Senator Atkinson, is you?
Thank you. Senator Decker, I enjoy your interest in campaign finance reform and would be very curious to hear your impressions of another campaign finance reform that was introduced to this here committee just last week. In response, or at the same time as the McCain-Feingold legislation was up, and which would move the primary mm-hmm. and shorten the timeline in which you could spend copious amounts of money. What do you think of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Axel, what's the relating clause on that bill? I think a fine idea would be, and I think I like that idea. I think that's a good idea. I think a really good mixture is that idea combined with, because I really do think that would compress an election cycle and at least create a tighter election. Although, from what I understand, Washington does have problems. Washington has that model. And from at least what I've heard, there is some issues in terms of a primary and a general just right back to back. But I do think it addresses, because I think it shortens the election cycle, and I think we should. I think it is kind of crazy, but I think that has something to do with the money that is in our, I mean, if you look at the money that's been dedicated to state legislative and gubernatorial and statewide races in Oregon, it has gone up exponentially in the 90s, and I think that causes longer election cycles. So I think that's helpful, but I really do, just to take one last whiff at my bill here, Mr. Chair, I do think this is a way of finding a middle ground on this issue, because it is limits, but I think they're reasonable limits. And I really believe, just hitting Senator Menace's point, is that I do think democracy and the nature of campaigns and the nature of what we engage in is so fundamental to who we are as people and as Oregonians that I think at least the notion that we have limited the amounts, I think not just that it has, we know through polling it has public buy-in, but I also think that it really, it does at least keep with the virtuous nature of what we're endeavoring in, because I know from my experience that in this campaign, we spent more time, because of the nature of having to raise the money, more time raising money than, I mean, too much time, where I could be out talking to voters and making my case, one-on-one or in small groups. And I do think that this, at least, is a creative way of meeting the court challenge that Senator Miller referred to, because this is completely voluntary. And I think combined with your idea, Senator Atkinson, I really do think it would be, a balanced system, you would have reasonable limits, they'd be voluntary, and I think it would be better, I would support your idea. I think this combined with that really does create a really truer, better election system. And you might notice in the bill, Mr. Chair, that we put this off, not to the next buy-in, because we already obviously have candidates that are vying for at least statewide office that are raising money, so we put this off a couple years, to ensure its inception coincides with a new cycle or a new political cycle.
That was thoughtful. Thank you. Senator Courtney.
Yes. I'm about ready to leave the process forever. I'm banned for life from ever coming back. And I've also lived at an age I don't want to talk about. So I think I can say this. I signed on to Representative Mark Hass's approach. I'm very grateful to Senator Decker for bringing this to us, and I will support Senator Atkins' approach to moving the two elections closer, because to me, this is, my tummy tells me in my latter years, I reached the twilight years of my life, and also the twilight years, in fact, the final years of my life here serving, that this is another situation where the public is really upset. They're very upset about this area. They really are. They're very, very angry. And we don't have to do anything about it this session. We can walk away from it. But I will tell you that this is another example that they did. I could tell you issue after issue where there were plenty of warning signs that the public was actually very angry and almost infuriated. And whether we like it or not, we can have discussions. There have been some great discussions philosophically about freedom of speech and whether or not it influences votes. But I really believe that the public will continue to do something about this until the courts finally say the public gets it right, if you will, unless we do something about it. And I think this session would do well. That's why I congratulated Senator Deckard and Representative Marquez and Senator Atkinson. She knows their D's and R's, as well as on both sides, for making a run at this. And we would do well. We would do well this session to try to either put something on the ballot or to pass legislation to try to deal with this in some ways that's respectful of freedom of speech, but as well as a reasonable amount of money to be competitive, but to acknowledge that the public really does want us to do something about that. And I think I just want to make that statement, Mr. Chair. So I thank Senator Deckard, Senator Atkinson, as well as others who are making a run at this thing.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn. Thank you, Senator Deckard. David, you're next.
Mr. Chair, can I just say one other thing? Is that all I would ask this committee to do is envision, under at least the provisions of Senate Bill 729, envision if it does meet the test that Senator Miller outlaid of being able to run a reasonable campaign, because I'm very open to reasonable limits mm-hmm. in terms of contribution and expenditures. And I think if it meets that test, at least that's one hurdle that no other state has been able to, other than Maine that I know of, put a system together that really does address the two issues and at least do it in a creative enough way that it seems to have strong bipartisan support, because it's not clamping down and giving mandatory low limits. It really, to me at least, that's all I would ask this committee is to take a look and see if it meets the test. And if you can envision a candidate for state senate or governor running under this system and actually be able to wage an effective campaign under the limits that we prescribe.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Harper, members of the committee. I'm David Buchanan, the Executive Director for Oregon Common Cause. We support the ideas of this bill. We support the ideas of the Representative Haas and Senator Courtney bill. In fact, I think that Senator Courtney's statement a few minutes ago pretty much summarized exactly what I wanted to say. The ideas are percolating. One of the biggest problems with this idea of campaign financing is we haven't had a lot of back and forth refining the ideas, letting them evolve and percolate into stronger ideas. We adopted the Oregon legislature adopted an idea in 1973 that was enacted and in place for one election cycle and was then overturned. And the voters in 1994 adopted another idea, and it was in place for an election cycle, and then it was overturned by the courts. If we'd had a dialogue with the courts saying these are the kinds of things you can and those are the kinds of things you can't do, the system would have evolved a lot further, a lot faster, and produced more different ideas and tested them out and found the strongest ones to keep, let the weaker ideas drift away and fall into disuse. Senator Deckard's idea isn't one that we agree with 100%, but it's the idea of looking for the answer to the problem. We agree that the problem is there and is quite significant, and I think the public thinks that the problem is quite significant. Let me talk about how a part of our election system evolved many years ago before the turn of the last century in the 1890s. We had a situation where voting was done in a kind of a haphazard way. There were a lot of different ideas about how you should vote, and enterprising candidates discovered that if they printed up little pieces of paper with their name on it and gave them to people as they were riding into town to go to the town square and and announce their votes. They discovered that it was easier. The voters kind of like that, to be able to say, okay, well, here's a pre-printed name that I can cast this ballot just by handing in the slip of paper. And then once one candidate tried to do that, other candidates thought, well, that's a good idea. Let's print up some ballots with our names on it. And then parties discovered that they could put a long list of candidates on it, and a voter would be able to hand in a slate card and cast their ballot more easily than having to recite who they were for each office. The party people then came up with the idea of printing them on unique colors of paper so that the spotters could more easily tell which piece of paper was being cast by which voter. After the voters and the process kind of percolated for a few years, the state took a hand in the process and said, there's an idea that's current in Australia. An Australian ballot was then proposed, and that idea was that the state would print all of the ballots, would call them official ballots. It's still in the statutes. It's called the official ballot because it had to be distinguished from all the other ballots that were in circulation at the time. So the official ballot became a state prerogative, and the state said, for fairness, for convenience, for all kinds of reasons, public demand, we'll go to the expense, we'll pay the money to provide this level of election service, so that the state then, the counties, took over the printing of official ballots at the expense of the taxpayer, because it was something that would improve the system. The public was kind of wanting a change in the system. They didn't like the disorderliness and the untidiness of these multiple ballots floating around. So the official ballot was created and enacted, and we take it all absolutely for granted now. We don't even have second thoughts that that's, well, you know, taxpayer money being spent on that election process. We think of it as normal. And over the years, the voters of Oregon have said there are several portions of the elections process that they don't mind paying for. In the early part of the century, the voter's pamphlet was created, and that's advertising for the candidates, but the voters like it. The voters think that that's a worthwhile investment of their tax dollars in the elections process. And the voter's pamphlet, the rules provide for equity and fairness and equal access and some limits and things like that. And so our system of taxpayer-financed elections includes paying for the ballots and paying for the voter's pamphlet. And then in the 60s, an idea of the tax credit came along. And so the tax credit was another way of having tax money help to enhance the election process. Now, in the last 10 or 20 years, almost all of the things that the taxpayers have invested in terms of having their election system run, have all been swamped by the huge volumes of money that are now part of the process. The tax credit is kind of an insignificant part of anybody's campaign anymore because it's such a small amount of money, and the real action is with the big money. So the idea that the taxpayers said, you know, that's a worthwhile use of tax funds for that. Let's enhance it in some way. Let's magnify it. Let's do something. Senator Miller would like to repeal it, but in some ways, it's almost like it's so little used, most people probably wouldn't notice its loss. But the reason that it was instituted was to help make the system work better. And I think that with Senator Deckert's idea, and with the idea introduced by Representative Haas, the idea is we need to do something to enhance the system, to make it work better, to make it fairer, more equitable, more useful for the taxpayers and for the voters. Let me give you one other analogy, and that is has to do with perceptions. Back in the, well, now that I try to think about it, in the 80s, I guess it was, when the Bhagwan was ensconced in eastern Oregon, we went through a little episode of concern about our voter registration process. Some people thought that the voter registration system was in danger of being swamped by activities and actions of certain people. Our Secretary of State then, Norma Paulus, assured us that no, the law takes care of any of these problems. There are mechanisms in the law of challenging registrations and various things. Well, that was fine for the legalistic of mine, but it wasn't. It didn't solve the perception problem. The perception problem was that there was a danger there, and even if the Secretary of State and the county clerks assured us that there were ways of handling it, the voters said we want something more to assuage our perceived fear of the problem, and that was to roll back voter registration from election day to 20 days before the election. So the public responded to something that was more of a perceived problem than a real problem, but they took the action that they thought would reassure their faith in the system. And we now have a 20-day voter registration cutoff because the people perceived that there was a problem that needed to be dealt with. I think the perception is there that there is a problem in campaign financing. A lot of debate has gone on. You can hear it on C-SPAN every day now for the last week. They've been discussing the same kinds of things. And it looks to me like they're actually going to take a step or two forward in the U.S. Congress. I think it's time for the legislature to take a step or two forward, try out some of these ideas, give them a chance, work with them, mold them into something that you can find some general agreement with, give the voters a little bit of hope that there's somebody working on these problems and trying to solve them. I think that'll go a long way toward reassuring the voters that the system is not beyond repair, is not beyond hope. I'll conclude with that and let you ask any questions if you have them.
Okay. Thank you, David. Senator Miller.
I just observed on the discussion regarding the political tax credit that that figure has gone up to, I think it's $8 million in a biennium. The difference, however, between it being a funding mechanism for this accountability fund and its current use is now you take the credit for giving to a particular cause or individual you believe in. To suggest that people would dump it into this big pit to be used by causes or candidates they don't care to support is it's not likely to amount to much. And I would also say that that would, at least I think that conclusion is consistent with the public's continued dislike for public financing campaigns.
I think the senator has a valid point. I think that the public does prefer the option of being able to identify to whom that contribution would go. In fact, I think that the tax credit would be the mechanism for qualifying candidates for other contributions. It would be a way of measuring public support. If a candidate has no public support, they shouldn't receive public reimbursement for their campaign expenses. But if a candidate does have public support, then I think that that signaling that by being able to raise a significant number of tax credits would be the a triggering mechanism that could then be part of the system. I think with Senator Deckard, if he thought that you could work some kind of a change and use the tax credit as a funding mechanism, as a triggering mechanism, excuse me, that might be something that he could live with and maybe want to work with you on finding some way to use that as kind of a citizen taxpayer allocating mechanism to be able to put money into the system. I think it's a good idea, and I think it's one of the experimental ideas that ought to be worked on and
contributing to the candidate of your choice.
Well, I think that that's it's a great system. And
the middleman.
And in fact, in the federal presidential system, they use contributions up to a certain amount as a triggering mechanism for providing public funds. I think that's a strong way of building the connection between a candidate and a public contribution to be able to put in a triggering mechanism based on how well they are do with connecting with the numbers of voters to be able to say, I want my tax credit contribution to go to this candidate.
All right, David, thank you very much. And
thank
with that,
you.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 729. We'll open the work session on committee bills. LC 4181, Senator Corcoran's Paige Yolen bill. We would like to submit as a committee bill. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And LC 4177. I need to open up each one separately. We'll open up LC 4177, which is the chair's bill on the ballot titles. Any discussion, objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And with that, we'll close the work session and we are adjourned.